From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Court of Protection has sanctioned the sterilisation of a man with learning difficulties. It's the first ruling of its kind in England and Wales. The 36-year-old had previously said he didn't want any more children after fathering a son in 2010. Leslie Keegan, a family lawyer, says sterilisation was the way forward.
It released him from the restrictions which had been placed on him by his family and indeed by his partner's family, because these families were struggling in trying to stop these vulnerable parties having another child.
2 days after more than 600 people died in Egypt, there's been more violence as supporters of ousted President Morsi take to the streets. 50 people have died in Cairo today. A man who posed as a teenager on Facebook to urge children to perform sex acts online has had his 16-month jail sentence trebled to 4 years. Appeal court judges agreed with the Solicitor General that the original term imposed on Francis Knight was unduly lenient. Dame Vivienne Westwood has made a surprise appearance at an exploration drilling site in West Sussex. The fashion designer is one of up to 1,000 extra people expected to take part in an anti-fracking protest near Bolcombe over the weekend. Distant relatives of King Richard III will be able to challenge plans to rebury his remains in Leicester. They were found under a car park in the city last year. Descendants are taking the case to the High Court, claiming that he wished to be buried in York. Leicester's mayor, Sir Peter Soulsby, says the motives are questionable.
The king himself didn't have any direct descendants, and they reckon that if you look at his close family, there could be as many as 1 million people in the UK today who could claim some sort of descent. So why this particular bunch of pretenders feel that they've got some exclusive right to be consulted, I really don't know.
And Coronation Street actor Chris Fountain's been suspended from the soap after he appeared in a YouTube clip rapping about violence and rape. The actor has apologised. That is the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Bristol's Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Education, Labour Councillor for Southmead, Brenda Massey. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, American Frank Wisner was the OSS officer who sprung Nazi war criminals from jail because he wanted them to help the USA fight the Cold War. But what's his son Frank Wisner Jr. been up to in Egypt? At least 650 supporters of democratically elected President Morsi are now known to have been killed and 4,500 injured in Wednesday's Rabah massacre. But Wisner describes this as inevitable. We get the USSS line on Egypt straight from the horse's mouth as we see more attacks on Coptic Christian churches. We ask, were these bombs planted by the Egyptian government's own interior ministry as they were at the beginning of the Arab Spring under Mubarak? And how independent are London think tanks Chatham House and RUSI, Royal United Services Institute, on all this? Also, what about the diabolical mess Bush and Blair left after our government's last illegal war in Iraq? Is the US occupation still going on? And what's being done about the continuing birth defects? Surely this is a concern for the World Health Organization. If not, why not? We hear from local author and depleted uranium expert Joe Baker. And zero-hours contracts. Over the last month, we've seen the government raise the number of people they thought were on these contracts from 150,000 to over 1 million. Can we trust employment statistics? And more importantly, what are your legal rights when your boss tells you you've got to move on to one? Or if you're already on one? Plus, in case you thought our condemned government supported a free press, broadcasts from around the world which are now banned. This week we hear from Syrian TV. And who's training Colombia's torturers? Tobias Tejani finishes last week's eye-opening dispatch from the heart of the Colombian jungle. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows 14 Celsius with a few clouds. This weekend, lows low 20s. Sunny periods with rain. Tomorrow, sunny and light rain, but sunny on Saturday with some rain around midday. Next week, warming up to mid 20s, dry with some good sunny days. Next weekend, 24th and 25th of August, feeling warm, around the mid-20s still, lots of sun. Week after next, and the good weather, rain-free, continuing on towards the end of August. So definitely looking better next weekend than this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. Helping us review this week's news is Bristol's Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Education, is Labour Councillor for Southmead, Brenda Massey. Hi Brenda, welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening Tony, thank you for inviting me.
Now, first of all, tell us about your role on the Cabinet, because I think I tend to be a little bit cynical and think, well actually really George is running things and you're there to make it look like there's a bit of democracy in the Cabinet.
Oh, there's certainly some democracy in the Cabinet. Yes, my role really is to look after the provision of education for all the children in Bristol and also to stand up for children in care and look after their interests. And you've probably recently seen all the outcome of the recent big Ofsted inspection we had. That was another thing we've been involved in recently.
Well, tell us about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, Ofsted, as you probably know, arrived in June and July to conduct an inspection of 15 schools across Bristol. And this was something we were surprised, actually, that a lot of those schools were waiting to be inspected and it had been held over. So that's obviously what was behind Ofsted's decision to come in and do a whole batch in one go. However, they were doing it really because it seemed to be the government line was that Bristol wasn't doing very well as far as education went. Thank goodness, by the time the Ofsted inspection had finished, we'd proved that actually we were doing much better than they anticipated. In fact, we'd gone up from 72% schools good or better level in March to 81%, which is where we are now, which I think everybody would agree is quite a significant increase.
Well, that's definitely some good news, but what about the bad news about young people generally and youth centres closing? Because we're seeing that right across the city at the moment, that the move to privatise, that is to get charitable institutions and others to take over from the council provision for youth centres, is proving to be a bit of a disaster in that we're having less and less of them. They're closing.
Yes, I don't think any of them have actually closed. What we've had is significantly reduced provision. And I have to say, this is something I inherited from the previous administration. It wasn't of my choosing. What I'm trying to do is alleviate the situation as much as possible. Obviously,
but you've got less money, Brenda, haven't
exactly.
you? You've got less money. So how are you managing to keep a youth service going?
Well, I think if you look at some of the neighbouring counties, they've actually completely cut all youth provision. We have managed to maintain some, but it isn't necessarily at the level people would want, although we are working as hard as we can to increase it. What is happening is in some cases, some of the sites are going to be going out to community asset transfer, where the buildings are offered to the local community for them to take over and run.
But how can the local community afford to run it? I mean, you used to pay staff. How can the local afford it? What do? Rattle buckets outside people's doors and ask for them to pay for
people? Well, that's quite a good idea. Maybe we should take that up. Yes, that might bring in a few extra pounds. Yeah, no, what will happen is that, and I know immediately that this isn't going to be appropriate for all communities because it will involve a considerable amount of hard work and dedication and, if you like, almost like business experience to take it over. There will be some support for communities that want to go ahead. The first one that started is actually Southmead Youth Club. In my own ward, the one I represent. And there has been a successful initial bid, which is now moving to the next stage where we'll be exploring this further, for the Southmead Development Trust to look into taking this on and running it.
So you're also responsible for education. Now, surely that's a shrinking role because you're seeing more and more children now being educated in these free schools and academies, which the City Council actually isn't responsible for. So you're seeing your role kind of shrinking down and down, not quite to nothing, but you're seeing at least some of the big money going into areas that you don't actually have any control over anymore.
We still have a statutory duty to provide a school place for every child of school age. So we do still have to do that. We are working very closely with the academies and the free schools. And I have to say that in most cases we're on very good terms with them. They do want to continue to work with us as a council. And There's a whole group of maintained schools, academies, free schools, all working together, and they are still very involved.
Now, these free schools are quite new. Can you tell us about some of those and where they are and how they work?
Right. Well, there are a number of them around, obviously, and one of the ones that might be coming on board, as you've probably read about recently, is the suggestion that the Cathedral School may well have a new school for a primary age school for children in the bottom two floors of the Central Library.
Okay, so yes, but there are also people who are saying that they don't want the Central Library closed off for that.
But it won't be closed.
I mean, how does that, something like the Cathedral, now that is a bit of an anomaly, isn't it? The Cathedral School, I'm guessing it's been there for hundreds of years. You know, the Cathedral's been there for such a long time. How does that fit in with general education provision in the city?
Well, you probably are aware that we have a huge shortage of places for children, particularly in the central area of the city, because it is really difficult. It's so built up to actually find a space where we can put either a new school or expand existing schools.
You know what? I bet the council sold off all their schools in that area because the land's worth a lot of money.
I don't think that's actually the case. I think we just literally haven't got space. It's office blocks, it's buildings, it's housing. And you know the population has risen so much over the last few years. It's a very significant increase. And I mean, it's really good that Bristol's such an attractive city for people to come to move to. But obviously, when they move here, families start having children and we have to find a space for them. So not going to go away in a hurry.
But we get back to my original question. How does the Cathedral School fit in? Is it funded by the church? Is it funded by the council? Or is it an independent school?
It's actually the money for the buildings will come from the government. And I think it's really unusual a way to help with solving some of our problems about having enough space for children. I would like to reiterate, it will not mean the Central Library closes. I use the library all the time. I'm in there practically every week. I would not countenance anything that meant that a library closed. My youngest son is a librarian in Oxford College. I mean, our family has always been into libraries, so there is no way that I would allow anything like that to happen. But what would probably happen would be that some of the books that are stored there that are not open for the public to use all the time, they're not on the shelves in the main part of the lending library because they're not in very good condition or they're quite old and in some cases are too fragile for people to use, along with newspapers that are stored down there too, will have to be found a better place to keep them, which hopefully will be somewhere that provides a much better environment for them. Because I visited it last week and had a look round, and these newspapers, there are huge bound copies there. If we're not very careful, they'll disintegrate before long. We need to save them. They're a resource that we need to look after.
But those who are criticising this idea are saying that this is just yet more public space which is being closed down and effectively privatised. It's being used by a private organisation, in this case the school, and not the public.
The public are not allowed in those bottom two floors. They're offices and storage space. They haven't been allowed down there for a very long time. For one thing, it's not compliant with the latest requirements for access for disabled people. This is one of the things that the school has actually got on their plans to improve the access there. But it isn't a space that the public have got any access to currently, and nor will have.
Okay, Brenda, we're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. A bit of good news this week, Martin. The good people of Cyprus, in the shape of the president, have decided that they want to announce a citizen's income. Now, you've been going on about this, along with some of the Green Party people we've had in there, for a long time, the idea of a citizen's income. Now, first of all, what is a citizen's income, and then what are they planning in Cyprus?
Well, the citizen's income was originally conceived by, would you believe, Milton Friedman, the free market economist of the Chicago School, and he called it negative income tax.
Now, he was somebody that Margaret Thatcher followed, for example.
Yes, he was. But basically the idea is this, is that there is a basic sort of level of standard of living, a basic standard of living that ought to be guaranteed to people in a civilised society. So that if your income falls below that level, it should be increased until it reaches that level. And once you're on above that level, you then become eligible for tax at some higher level. So in other words, basically how it would work, and I think in Denmark they considered doing this in the 1990s, they're probably the most progressive European state, they're saying, right, well, every citizen over the age of 16 will get a basic income which allows them to survive. And the beauty of it is that unlike what you do is you abolish all sorts of existing benefits, and because, you know, the benefit system has grown up over many years. So you get mortgage tax relief, for example. People think they don't get benefits, but anybody who gets mortgage tax relief is actually getting a benefit because there's no capital gains on house prices rising. All of that is taken away and you give everybody a basic income. Now, that means, of course, that if you're sick, unemployed, disabled, then you've got an income, which is the same as everybody else. But of course, the beauty of it is that you can then work on top of that income without losing that income. So the universal credit being brought in by Ian Duncan Smith is sort of halfway there and missing the point.
Well, one of the nice things about it is it cuts out a massive amount of the bureaucracy. At the moment, I'm getting about two letters a week from the DSS because my amount of money I get fluctuates from, I don't know, something like £5 a week up to about £20-30 a week, and then down, and it's going up and down the whole time. So,
and every time that happens, the people are paying your benefits or whatever it is have to recalculate. And the same is true of housing benefit. And all benefits, because the means testing is inefficient because it takes a huge amount of time and effort to assess, because people's circumstances change continuously. So the beauty of having a citizen's income is everybody just gets paid it, bang, and then of course they are secure. So in other words, it creates what the president of Cyprus is trying to do is reassure the population that we are not going to let you fall down a hole. So they can breathe a sigh of relief, pensioners, whoever they are, and breathe a sigh of relief, because up to now, you see, like many southern European countries, they've got unemployment benefit, which is insurance based, which only lasts for 6 months, and after that you're on your own or dependent on your family.
So just reading from the Famagusta Gazette, I'm sure this is one that you regularly read, Martin. The amount of the guaranteed minimum income will take into consideration the needs of every citizen and every household related to nutrition, clothing, electricity consumption and other essential supplies. It will also ensure the right to housing for those economically weaker groups of the population, either by subsidising the rent if the beneficiaries do not own a home, or by subsidising the interest on mortgage loans in cases where home ownership has become problematic. Furthermore, the guaranteed minimum income will be provided to thousands of citizens who are not covered so far by existing welfare and don't receive any substantial help from the state, such as unemployed graduates of colleges and universities, those who have a very low income, and self-employed people who have then become unemployed. So, I mean, essentially, I mean, am I thinking here, Martin, that what they're doing is they're getting away from a system where certain people in Cypriot society, as our society, are just not entitled to anything? I mean, we've got, for example, a big age gap, haven't we, for young people, where they're just not entitled to any money at all.
Well, indeed, and I think also the Grillisti in Italy have also been demanding a similar thing. They want €1,000 for every Italian citizen per month, guaranteed. And this is not like Ian Duncan Smith's universal credit, because it's just guaranteed. You just get it, and it's very easy. So anybody, what you could say is you've got to be on the electoral register to get it, and you've got to vote. Then it really is.
But they then call it a poll tax.
No, it's
because it's not a tax.
It's not a tax. And you could actually underpin the political system with this and say, right, you're not entitled to this unless A, you're on the electoral register, and B, you can show you participated in the last election. Because if you haven't done that, you're not a citizen and you're not entitled to.
Well, that's not fair. If you're an anarchist, you won't get any money.
Well, you can go and spoil your ballot, but you will turn up. Otherwise, you don't have the money.
Okay.
Anyway, but I mean that's an elaboration. I think what's beginning to happen in the crisis, and don't forget, you see, in Iceland during the crisis, they didn't decrease unemployment benefits because it's a small country and everybody knows somebody who's unemployed in their family. They increased unemployment benefits, and this is what actually happens at a certain stage of a crisis. People suddenly think, this is silly. We've actually just got to look after people. We're not there yet in this country. No, we're marching in the wrong direction.
Why is it that these fascinating new initiatives seem to come from these little tiny islands? I mean, we're an island, but we're not as tiny as Iceland or Cyprus, are we?
Because small places like that, people actually know each other, and it's a cohesive community.
I suppose the politicians can't get away. So
they can't get away. That's right. I mean, in Iceland, with 250,000 people or whatever, the politicians, you know, they sent their bankers to the prison. They refused to pay their debts, and in actual fact, their economy economy is growing faster than anybody else's in Europe. But of course, they doubled unemployment benefits or something similar.
Okay, before we ask Brenda about this, Martin, how would we pay for it here?
What you do, it's all been costed out many years ago. Don't forget, you're abolishing all other benefits. Yeah? So you get
this is just like Ian Duncan Smith wants to do.
Well, indeed, it's called real welfare reform. And of course, the other thing you do is you abolish things like mortgage tax relief. Rather than just providing subsidies, which the government are doing now with Help to Buy, they're providing subsidies for people who already own their own homes to buy bigger homes. That's absurd. You should withdraw all subsidies.
No,
to the
but
middle
it keeps,
class,
the, it keeps well the house as, prices up. That's the point of it, isn't it?
Well, yes, but that's a subsidy from the taxpayer to the to homeowners, which
but
is in
the,
fact
I mean, the government
wrong
knows.
In principle and
yeah,
wrong
but
in
the government knows
in
we can't allow house prices to sink because the whole economy will then start bottoming out.
No, but what you should be doing is actually providing more social housing so you can stabilise the price of housing. What's happened in Germany, the price of houses hasn't altered in 40 years. And we in Britain are so used to the idea that the middle class just get their free money. Once they're on the ladder, where's my free money? And it is free money from society. So all of those people that have made money on the housing bubble, that is free money from society just as much as claimants on benefits.
Okay, Martin. Brenda, what do you make of this? The Cypriots seem to have come up with something here which is a bit of a solution to the awful problems that they've had and austerity. They're saying everybody's going to get a guaranteed minimum income.
I think it's a really unusual idea. I think it's got a lot to be said for it.
Well, it's not totally. We've had the Green Party on here saying this. The Green Party have been banging on about this for years in Britain. Why hasn't the Labour Party?
I can't answer for that one, I'm afraid, but I do think it's well worth looking into, and I actually do like Martin's idea about having to be on the electoral roll and actually go and use your vote too, because unfortunately not enough people actually bother to go out and do that.
They would have a very clear incentive.
Yes. Yeah? Yeah.
If you don't do this, you don't get this money.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen the participation, the democratic participation in voting over the years has dropped and dropped
but
and dropped.
But if people don't want to vote, Brenda, why should they?
Well,
they don't have to have the money.
Martin,
yeah.
Ask Brenda, actually. Yeah, Brenda.
I think everybody, if you think about how hard people fought to get the vote, I think people really should go out and use it. And as Martin said, if they decide they don't want to vote for anybody in particular, just spoil the vote. But you should really put some thought into it and go and vote for whoever you think best represents your interests.
Okay, and now Fish Ponds hits the national news. This doesn't happen every week, does it? Joan Edwards, David Cameron faces calls to apologise over the row about a midwife's £520,000 donation. The Conservatives and Lib Dems channel the money into their party coffers, taking £420,000 into the Tory and £100,000 into the Lib Dem private purse. Each. Now, David Cameron faced calls to apologise over the row, which saw the Tories and Lib Dems try to grab this money from a retired midwife's estate. What were your thoughts about this one, Brenda?
I just found it unbelievable that they would actually decide that that money was going to them. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Well, surely it's just the solicitors that have approached them. I mean, you know, the actual wording on the will was that she wanted the proceeds of her estate to pay to whichever government is in office at the day of my death, for the government in their absolute discretion to use as they may think fit. Now, the government, I mean, that isn't the Tory party. The Tory party is not the government. The government is the cabinet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the Tory party makes up the government, but it isn't the government. Martin, what is the definition of the government?
Well, I think this has put a spotlight on what it actually is, isn't it? I think, to be fair, but I think both Lib Dems and Conservatives have thought about it and decided that they're not going to take the money, which is probably just as well. I mean, therefore, even if her wishes were that they should have it, they have decided to pass it on. I think, isn't it interesting where we're talking about people voting and not voting and so on, and this is somebody who's obviously been, I believe she was a churchgoer and so on. She's genuinely, you know, when people say we're all in it together, she is genuinely trying to help the rest of society, and she should be commended for what she's done here.
Okay, Martin, now answer the question. The government, what does the word actually mean?
Well, I think the interpretation has been that this money will now be used to pay down the deficit for everybody, and that seems fair enough, doesn't it? I understand that Joan Edwards could have bought her own council house and chose not to. Very interesting.
I mean, as I understand it, it's actually the cabinet, which is made up of different political
parties.
Well, you
could say anybody, the government could be anybody working for the government, the whole structure of the government, couldn't it? Basically, the government isn't the government of the... we're arguing here whether it should be for politicians or for the government machine, if you like. And I think, you know, there's a general consensus, and I think Cameron and Clegg have agreed with this, that this money should not be used for party political purposes. It should be used to, you know, to help Britain as a whole. And I think that's fair enough. I think everybody's come to a conclusion about that, which seems to make sense to me.
The way I read it initially when I looked at this story first time was that it was the way some people have in the past said the money is to go to pay off the national debt. And I was making the assumption that it was something like that, or, as you said, Martin, for general good purposes. I didn't read it.
Did she want it just to go to the banks then? I mean, maybe she should have said that.
Well, yes, that's one of the things.
Can we know?
when she wrote the will, the Labour Party were in power. So, and she couldn't, you know, so we could argue, well, we should have a bit
of... But she said the government of the day. Anyway, I just think it's incredible that this has actually come out, because it looks to me as if solicitors have been on the phone to solicitors and organising things, and I think the moral of the story is make sure you find out what your solicitors are up to, especially when it comes will and probate. And isn't it, I think, the case that wills are become, once they become opened and read, that they become public property, so you should be able to find out what is in a will. Anybody can find it out. And they certainly have here. The next story is a shady defence. Clarence House stands up for Prince Charles's lobbying incontinence. Now, this is Paul Flynn we've had on this show from Newport, the Labour MP, who's called Prince Charles's lobbying incontinence. This came out in the Mail last weekend. Brenda, Prince Charles has been doing really what the Queen does with the Prime Minister once a week, but he's been doing it with the individual cabinet ministers every month for the last several years. And this has only now become known. We've also had a scandal recently about the Prince's black spider letters. So he's not only going to visit them, he's also writing these little black spidery letters to these cabinet ministers. And one assumed telling them what to do or advising them in some way. And I really want to ask you, as we have been talking about this the last few weeks, what is the role of people like Prince Charles nowadays? Because we had a civil war. The idea is the royalty is there to look good and to attract tourism, not to start lobbying and having privileged access to the very heart of power.
I was quite shocked when I heard about this initially, because I don't think it's his role to get involved in the fact that he apparently has a veto on legislation while he is not actually the monarch. Because whatever you think about whether it should be, the country should be a republic, it currently is a monarchy, and the Queen has a certain statutory position. But I don't see why Prince Charles should be involved in this to the extent that he's exercising a veto over legislation in the way it appears to be here. It's slightly different to when he used to talk about monstrous carbuncles and such like with regard to architecture. That's an opinion, but to actually be able to exercise a right of veto over potentially laws that would affect his own private interests, that's a completely different issue.
Martin, he's going to face scrutiny soon from MPs over his lobbying, and particularly over this idea that anything that affects his estate, that is to say his own personal private estate as well as the Duchy of Cornwall, he can veto. So what about this latest revelation that not only has he been writing these letters backwards and forwards, the Guardian has been pursuing that story, we now hear in the Daily Mail that he's also visiting. He takes a very, very great interest in politics. It's certainly not some sort of symbolic monarch that we were told he was before.
Well, I think that's right, and I think Brenda's shown that. I mean, he's entitled to have some opinions about things, and fair enough. But I mean, when he's lobbying behind the scenes for his own personal interests, I think that raises a red light. And it's only just come to light that he has this veto. I mean, this can't be right in this day and age for an individual like that to have a veto over legislation that's already been passed through both houses.
The monarchy has been fighting a long-running court battle to keep the secret the contents of 27 letters Charles wrote to ministers in 2004-2005 on the grounds that public them could undermine his position of political neutrality.
He shouldn't have written them then, should he?
I mean, he obviously he obviously doesn't have a position of political neutrality, and that's what that's telling you. The campaign group Republic said the Queen and Prince's consent rule gives the Prince of Wales an effective veto on legislation which allows Charles to insist on changes to laws which affect his private interests. Well, it sounds to me like the Civil War never happened.
Well, yes, and I think don't forget, this is any other letter to a minister would in fact be public property. Now, if he wants to play that game, fine, but we want transparency at the very least. We want to know what's going on, and people can make their own judgments.
Just a throwback a few hundred years. I mean, Brenda, we had a civil war. Lots of people died. It was pretty terrible in the 1640s. And essentially, what happened was we had a feudal system, and it was replaced by the merchant classes, who traditionally had run places like Venice. You'd had city-states run by merchants, but we'd never had a country in the world which was entirely run by merchants. And that's what happened after the Civil War. Martin, you're shaking your head. Go on.
Well, I'm just saying that's a somewhat tendentious
To try and summarise it. It's gone from a feudal system to a merchant class running the country. I mean, if you were an MP, what would you be asking Prince Charles about his role? Because it does seem that he wants to keep everything private. For example, he's keeping freedom of information requests just bounce off him. They don't work if you try and find out what Charles is up to. And yet, you know, one would have thought that he's part of the government. He gets a massive public subsidy.
Absolutely, and I don't see why he shouldn't be subject to the same laws as everybody else is. We have to be aware of freedom of information and supply letters, emails, whatever, if a request is made for them. So I don't see any reason why he can't. And if he's taking public money, he shouldn't be meddling behind the scenes in this way.
Well, if you're ever driving up or on the bus on the way up to Cirencester and passing in Tetbury, maybe give him a piece of your mind. You know, I certainly will.
We wouldn't get in through the gates, would we?
Well, no, they do tours apparently. I think if you can have a afternoon tea there is, I think, £85, something like that. And you're allowed
snip.
You're allowed to buy Prince Charles and various royal pottery and things like that, but there's no pictures of Diana anywhere. Anyway, that's on the way.
Well, I know
just
all
on the
these
way.
Dutchy original foods are very expensive.
Yes, it's just on the way to Tetbury, on the left-hand side. Anyway, house prices are picking up, but beware the north-south divide. Britain's housing market's coming back to life, amazingly enough, after being almost halted by the banking crisis, but its revival's widening the north-south divide, stoking fears of the economy overheating. London prices rising at 8.1% annual rate, according to the latest figures, but in Scotland prices are falling by 0.9%, in Northern Ireland down by 0.4%. This is Andy McSmith in The Independent, Martin. House prices are rising at their fastest pace since 2006. Sounds to me like the recession is over, virtually.
Well, I think we've had wall-to-wall quantitative easing for 4 years and over, and all we've got is house prices beginning to rise at this stage of the game, largely as a result of the Help to Buy scheme that Osborne has brought in.
Or the Help to Sell, as a lot of people have called it.
Indeed. I mean, what we're doing here is using taxpayer resources to subsidise the already fortunate, while the unfortunate are facing bedroom taxes, cuts in benefits, and there's 14,000 plus people on the housing waiting list here in
Britain. So this housing is a very important economic indicator. Everyone looks at it. So what would happen if house prices started to go down?
And what we really...
Everyone get very gloomy.
As I mentioned earlier, in Germany, house prices haven't moved anywhere in 40 or 50 years. Because that's because people don't invest in bricks and mortar to try and improve their lot. They invest in new businesses, what they call the Mittelstand in Germany.
So it's not used as part of the casino economy for gambling, that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, you've got lots of small and medium enterprises in Germany, and if people have got spare cash, they put them into that. So when you're sitting in a sort of upper middle class dinner party in Germany, they're not talking about house prices, they're talking about their latest business ventures. And that's the difference between Britain and Germany. But of course, what Osborne is doing, it just in time for the next election, he's trying to create a feel-good factor in southeast England marginals. It's pretty cynical, and of course the other thing is that house prices rise in the southeast of England, and then the brakes have to be slammed on, interest rates have to rise, and that's before that the Midlands and the North have started to get going. It's called stop-go, or rather go-stop, and it's been the problem with the British economy for the last 100 years. And here we go again.
Brenda, public interest has been shown. The government are very happy that it's been shown. George Osborne's Help to Buy scheme introduced in April, under which buyers of newly built homes with values up to £600,000 are eligible for a government loan worth a quarter of the price. So that's a £150,000 loan from the government, in which they pay no interest for 5 years. So that's obviously going to help you buy the house. But what about the long term? Is this helping in the long term?
Well, I think one of the problems we've got to think about is not just this part of it, but it's also the people who are being so badly affected by the bedroom tax, in that there is nowhere for most of these people to move. What we need are more smaller houses, sort of one and two bedroom ones, because at the moment it's no good saying somebody has to move out if there's absolutely nowhere for them to go. So looking at a house worth £600,000 is completely out of the realms of probability for the majority of the people that we look after.
So it's helping the more wealthy who don't need it rather than those. Martin, also, I'm a bit worried. This is a little bit like the subprime thing, isn't it? Where the Americans were helping. So just explain, what was the subprime and how is it similar?
Well, I mean, in the US, the idea became that they pushed the idea that everybody should own their own home because they were hostile to the idea of publicly owned housing. But of course, everybody can't afford to own their own home. If you're going to have a free market economy with a big wage differential, the bottom half of the population cannot afford to buy their own home. So therefore, you either build them a home, like a council house or social housing, or you subsidise them to buy their own home. But of course, once you're subsidising people to buy their own home, you're A, wasting, you've got to find the money to subsidise it, and B, of course, you're possibly putting people in a situation where they can't pay. But of course, the people who are selling these subprime mortgages then sold them on to others. So what I do is I sell you a subprime mortgage, subsidised by the government, and then I give it to somebody else. So if you don't pay, it's not my problem.
Hey, that's a good idea. So you could get the money from the government on no interest for 5 years, and you could start gambling and speculating.
Yes, well, that's what will happen. Most of the houses that were sold, we were talking about council house sales earlier, many council houses have ended up as rent to buy to let. So what used to be social housing at a reasonable rent is now private housing at a much
But the government are saying they're not going to allow people to use this for buy-to-let, although they can buy second homes.
Yes, so we're subsidising second homes while other people are being kicked out of their houses because they've got too many rooms. So it's class warfare, isn't it?
Brenda, you're shaking your head there.
Unbelievable. One of the other issues that's also impacting on the housing market at the moment is the number of houses that are being bought up, extended and turned into flats, and that's happening in lots and lots of places. So what would have been a normal three-bedroom house available for a family to buy is being bought up by developers and turned into flats for, you know, six, eight, different sets of people there. So that's another way that the housing market's declining.
More bad news, I'm afraid, on the railways front. We're going to hear now from the Transport Secretary. I'm going to put a little quiz for you two. Do you know who the Transport Secretary is? Brenda first.
I'm thinking hard.
I think Philip Hammond used to be, didn't he? But he was moved over to defence when Leon Fox was found to be spending a bit too much time with someone who was trying to fit up a case for a war with Iran. Martin, who's the Transport Secretary?
Casey Jones?
No. It's Patrick McLaughlin. So let's hear from him now. Here he is defending the idea of raising rail prices again at the beginning of next year by a little, I think it's 1% above inflation now, so that's up about 4.5% next year, again keeping us, of course, in our cars.
Look, nobody likes to see rail fares go up. I don't like to see rail fares going up, and obviously the passenger doesn't want to see rail fares going up. But what we are doing is we're massively investing in our railways at the moment. I'm here this morning on Nottingham Station. £130 million is being spent upgrading this station, upgrading the signalling. That's happening all over the country. Reading Station, £800 million. Birmingham Station, £600 million. That's the station infrastructure. That's also goes alongside all the work that's doing in replacing rolling stock and upgrading our tracks. So running the railways is a very expensive business. The taxpayer overall is still putting in huge amounts of money into the railways, and I'm afraid the passenger also has to make his contribution. He does it as a taxpayer, but he has to also do it as a person who's using the train as well. We've seen a vast growth in the number of people using the trains. I welcome that. I think that's very good news for the country as a whole. But basically, passenger numbers have gone up from 750 million to 1.5 billion on the latest figures. So, you know, we are seeing more people using the railways. And as I say, as a result of that, we're putting in unprecedented amounts of money into investment. You know, we've announced plans to electrify 850 miles of a line. The last government only electrified 10 miles of line. So there's huge investment planned. Most of the franchises that are operating funding were actually negotiated by the last government. There have been some mistakes made as far as franchising is concerned. I was very upfront about that and put action into put that right straight away. I could go on. The Labour Party may say that these fares are unnecessary. During their time, they were increasing the fares at the same level. What we're doing as well is also driving up the levels of investment, so people get more reliable train services and they get better facilities as well.
Well, I found that on the excellent YouTube channel called Liar Politicians. Brenda, this is very frustrating for people, particularly those who would like to see less cars, more trains, to hear that actually the fares are going up above inflation yet again. At least we're hearing that there is investment in the railways.
Yes, but the price of train fares at the moment, I used to go up and down to London quite frequently by train, and if you came home from Paddington at night, you'd be paying an awful lot of money with no guarantee of having a seat, for one thing. I remember standing for one journey crammed in the restaurant space, and nobody could actually move. Even if you had a seat, once you got on, you were literally being held up by everybody else around you, and you were paying an awful lot of money for that. So it's ridiculous to keep on putting up and up fares, because as you said, people want to use trains more, but the increased cost is going to price them out of doing that and put them back into their cars.
Martin?
I think the most significant thing that he said there was that the government is putting lots and lots of money into the railways. That's right. In actual fact, the government is spending 300% more on the railways than they did when they were owned by British Rail, owned by the public sector. But of course, what he didn't mention there is that the shareholders of the railway companies are taking their slice. That's why... This is the whole reason why privatising railways was such a ridiculous idea in the first place. And of course, New Labour did not do anything about it during their time in power. Incidentally, might be interesting to Brenda, in New Zealand, the Labour Party split in the early 80s exactly over this kind of issue. And what was called New Labour in New Zealand forced a PR referendum, won an election in alliance with the Greens and the Maori Nationalists. And the first thing they did was re-nationalise the railways, which had been privatised by the Labour government. And they haven't got a big railway system in New Zealand.
No, they haven't.
They privatised it. The Labour government in 1980 privatised the railways. Yeah. And that was a red rag to the unions and the activists, and they overturned it and they put it back in the public sector.
Yeah, what about this electrification, though? Because it worries me. There's a lot of money goes into it, and also it costs an absolute fortune to maintain all these electric wires all the way down the track. So there's also obviously private businesses thinking, oh, that's a great contract for us to be maintaining the electric wires for the next 30, 40 years. So in a way, it's not necessarily such a wonderful thing to be doing this electrification. I still haven't seen any sign of it happening on the line to Paddington from here. Martin, at least he's saying that there is actually a lot of investment going in.
Yes, I know, but we're doing it. The government is actually having to fund it, because the private sector won't pick up the slack, because the private sector doesn't. There was Norman Foster, the architect. I was watching him on television the other night. He's put forward a proposal to completely change the railway system. So you've got a link to Europe, and it goes it goes round London and links the northern cities. And in Japan they've got these maglev trains which don't run on wheels. Now, if you're thinking in terms of it. Maglev trains, they don't run on
wheels. Magnetic levitation
trains. And they're incredibly fast and efficient. Now, ultimately, a Labour government, probably with allies from other parties, will want to actually reboot the British economy. And you don't want to mess about trying to get private sector money to electrify the trains. You go ahead and completely change. You go to another level altogether. Yeah, think 50 years ahead. Now, we're not there yet, because we're still in this mindset where we can't have what we want because there's no money. There's plenty of money. It's all in the Cayman Islands. We've got to get it back.
Okay, over to Southmead now, and UK wages decline amongst the worst in Europe. Well, it's not just Southmead, but obviously there's a lot of people live in that part of town who are on quite low wages already. Wages in the UK have seen one of the largest falls in the European Union during the economic downturn, according to official figures. Requested by the Labour Party and collated by the House of Commons Library, they show average hourly wages have fallen 5.5%. in the mid since mid 2010, adjusted for inflation. It's the fourth worst decline among all the 27 EU nations. By contrast, Germany's hourly wages rose by 2.7% over the same period. Across the EU as a whole, average wages fell 0.7%. Only the Greek, Portuguese and Dutch workers have had a steeper decline in hourly wages. Other countries have suffered during the Eurozone debt crisis, also fared better than Britain. Spain had only a 3.3% drop over the same period, and salaries in Cyprus fell by 3%. Now, this is felt very hard in places where there's more low-wage earners, Brenda. I mean, how is this actually hitting people? I mean, we've heard the figures, but how is it actually hitting people on the ground in Southmead?
Well, I think one of the other issues coming out from this is the impact on families, where they're actually having to depend on getting food from food banks because they just haven't got enough money to go out and buy the normal weekly shopping. And in some cases, parents are going without food to make sure that the children have something to eat. If your wages are so low that you can only just about pay your rent or, you know, for fuel, because that's another issue that's rising, it's an awful indictment of where we are.
Martin, the falls in nominal wages during this recession are unprecedented, the Institute for Fiscal Studies has said. 2009, the average public sector worker earned about £16.60 an hour, which dropped to £15.80 in 2011. Meanwhile, hourly pay for private sector workers was just over £15.10 an hour and has dropped to £13.60, so a massive fall in the private sector.
Yeah, well, the fact is that the macroeconomic effect of squeezes on wages is that you're actually draining demand out of the economy. People who are on wages tend to spend their money on stuff. And we've seen the richest 1% in Britain during the crisis have actually increased their net worth.
But what do you mean by massive stuff?
Well, they go out and buy things with it, but what you've got with the wealthy, the wealthy have actually made lots of money out of quantitative easing. Asset prices, including house prices, have been artificially protected by quantitative easing and low interest rates. And of course, that means, but those people don't spend that money. They then take it back to the stock market to pump it back in, which is why you've got the stock market going north and the economy going south. And at a certain point, that is going to cause a crash. And as I've said to people, other people on this show week after week, Brenda, if we have a crash, and it does happen, I don't want to hear from the government of the day, the Con Dem, or from the Labour front bench that who could have predicted that, what are we going to do now? The civil service should be, as we speak, working on a plan for what happens when we have a subsequent crash. I don't want to hear from the head of the civil service or the Bank of England, if there is another crash, we haven't got a plan. I want that plan ready to go. And I'm not wishing a crash, I'm just saying if it happens, I don't want to hear that there isn't a plan, because we will be absolutely furious.
Okay, in a nutshell, what would your plan be, Martin?
Well, you're probably going to have to start thinking in terms of having public, proper nationalised banks, instead of just chucking money at the existing private sector system. We say, right, we're going to have a Bank of England, which will belong to the people of England, if you like. I mean, in North Dakota, in the US, they've got the Bank of North Dakota, which was set up in the 1900s by radical farmers, populist farmers, and it's the only solvent state in the US, because it's still having a big state-owned bank run by the local government of North Dakota has actually worked very, very well
for them. I suppose when that bank makes profits, they can plough that back into the local area.
That's right.
Sounds like a bit of a no-brainer, doesn't it?
The sort of thing they've got in Germany as well.
More bad news, I'm afraid. Gas and electricity bills could rise by £140 before winter, despite the energy companies making £3.3 billion profits since last election. This is another privatisation which seems to have been just simply rip off Britain, isn't it? Brenda, massive increases. This says gas and electricity bills could rise by 10% before the winter. That's £140 for each of us. Households have been warned, despite energy companies enjoying £3.3 billion profits since the last election.
What we're going to be seeing if we get a bad winter again is what we've seen previously, where people will be, and particularly pensioners, for instance, will be not turning their heating on and will be sitting there going without, because they will not be able to afford to pay these bills, which have just risen and risen and risen. And I mean, even this last week, I was talking to somebody in my ward, and he said he turns everything off, unplugs everything he possibly can, cuddles up in a duvet and a hot water bottle just to keep warm in the winter because he just cannot afford to pay the bills.
Martin, since 2009, Britain's big six energy companies, British Gas, E.ON, EDF, Npower, Scottish Power and SSE, have been required to report to the regulator Ofgem on their annual profits for generating and selling power. Between them, they supply 98% of all the households in Britain. And also, of course, there's an investigation into price fixing going on amongst these energy providers. So what are your thoughts about this potential £140 annual increase?
Well, privatising infrastructure like this was always wrong.
But that's a 10% increase. I mean, we're hearing about 4.4% for rail fare.
Well, this is an oligopoly, to use the textbook phrase. So they've got a collusive pricing strategy. So they've got the consumers where they want them, and they can raise prices willy-nilly because people have got to pay them. I mean, you can't really switch from one to another to bring your prices down because they're all marching in lockstep. This is the reason why these industries were nationalised in the first place. And don't forget, the things like gas and electricity were started off as municipal enterprises. In Birmingham, Joseph Chamberlain set up the gas industry, and he used the profits from giving everybody gas to fund the Birmingham City Council's activities in the community. And by giving this to these income streams to private interests, that 3.3 billion in profits should, in fact, be used to reduce. I mean, if you've got a publicly owned industry, you don't have to run at a profit. You have to run to break even. And therefore, of course, small firms that are trying to export into the international market, this is actually raising their costs and therefore making it less possible for them to compete with whoever, the Germans, the Japanese, whatever. Everything in Britain is run for the benefit of a speculative financial elite. And that is why the economy has been hollowed out over a generation.
Well, Labour's new research shows that the total profits, that is earnings before interest and taxation, I guess that's gross profits rather than net profits, of the big six energy companies increased from staggering figures, these, £2.158 billion in 2009 to, and I'll miss out some of the middle figures, to 3.737 billion in 2012. I mean, that's over the space of just 3 years. They've almost doubled from 2 billion to nearly 4 billion. That's a massive amount of money.
It is, yeah. But I mean, we get used to in this country.
That's going to the shareholders.
Like yes, exactly. The railways, all of these utilities were nationalised for a reason. I mean, in Norway, they've got their own state-owned oil industry, which has provided a sovereign wealth fund, which will be providing for their pensioners and their toddlers for the next 50 years. Ours has just gone down the drain. What happened to it all?
Well, Gregory Lauder-Frost has exposed. This is our next story. The Tory fringe group leader with Nazi sympathies. This is in the Independent at the weekend. Now, this is Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's gone to do a talk for this. He's a Conservative MP locally for a traditional Britain group. He's claimed the decision to award a peerage to the mother of the murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence, that's Doreen Lawrence, was an example of a modern fashion for filling the House of Lords up with spivs. That Mr. Lauder-Frost and his organisation were a little noticed Tory fringe group until the website Liberal Conspiracy revealed that Mr. Rees-Mogg had been a guest speaker at one of its dinners and highlighted some of its questionable views. Mr. Lauder-Frost said of Mrs. Lawrence, "We do not feel there's any merit in raising such a person to the peerage. She's a complete nobody. She has been raised there for politically correct purposes. She's just a campaigner about her son's murder. It's ridiculous. She has made countless anti-English comments over the last 10 years. She's no friend of the English people, Brenda."
I had the privilege of meeting Mrs. Lawrence a few weeks ago. She came to Bristol to address the Association of Bristol Governors and visited some of the schools, and I just find it unbelievable that anybody could say this about her. This is so wrong. I mean, look at some of the other people that are in there now. It's just ridiculous. I don't know what he was thinking of to say those things. It's so wrong.
Now, Jacob Rees-Mogg, to be fair to him, has backtracked now. He's saying that he didn't really mean to go to this speak at this dinner. He didn't realise that the traditional Britain group had such racist views. And what are your thoughts about him backtracking now?
Well, why didn't he check up in the first place? He's got an office, he's got staff. Surely they would find out about this. But he went along there and he spoke. It's just unbelievably... well, I words fail me, to be honest, about him.
Martin, Gregory Lord of Frost said, "This woman, Doreen Lawrence, has done the British nation no favours whatsoever. If these people don't like us and want to keep attacking us, they should go back to their natural homelands."
Yes, and he also says here, "The Nuremberg trials were a farce. They were show trials without an ounce of legitimacy. The Africans never had it so good as when Britain governed their countries. We owe Africa nothing whatsoever. The Poles asked for it from 1919 onwards. It was Britain and France who made it a world war, not Hitler. Basically, if you do not want to be bombed, you should not have declared war on a country, Germany, who had no quarrel with you." So this chap is, no doubt about it, a neo-Nazi, part Absolutely. Of the traditional Britain group. And you seem to feel like reminding him, we fought a world war against those opinions, and if you want those opinions, we will defend to the death his right to have those opinions. But he's basically a Nazi. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, Conservative MP, posh chap, been on our show, shouldn't have been there, should he?
Absolutely.
Next story. A new company allows organisations to hire fake protesters. Now, I'm thinking a little bit of down in Balcombe here and the big fracking protest that's going on over the weekend. So no one supports your cause. No problem. You can hire supporters, even protesters. A company started last October by 22-year-old Adam Swart provides this service. In a telephone interview, he said, "I came up with the idea on a visit to Estonia. At the airport, I saw a man who was being swarmed by a crowd of excited onlookers. I thought, why can't I have that kind of attention?" And so Swart's company, Crowds on Demand, was born. Martin.
Well, I mean, this is what they call in the US astroturfing. The Koch brothers, for example, put millions, billions of dollars into creating the Tea Party movement, which they then said was a grassroots movement against high taxes and for a smaller state. But in actual fact, whenever we on the left try and organise, we're always struggling to try and find resources to pay for everything. I mean, when we take people on anti-war demonstrations, people have to pay for the bus tickets and all the rest of it. We haven't got any kind of money to back us up. Meanwhile, the right wing can create, they've got millions to create, false organisations which wouldn't exist probably if the money wasn't there. And I remember that in the last election the Conservatives were in fact paying people to knock on doors for them. It was ever thus. The wealthy, I mean, back in the 18th century, I was just reading a book about this earlier. I mean, people, you know, Conservative politicians and other Whig politicians would pay the mobs to intimidate their rivals and so on. It's back to the future. Oh,
the Conservatives may be having to do this again, because I noticed at the end of the beginning of this week there was an announcement that their membership is now down to only 100,000 members from 200,000 roughly at the time of the last general election. Anyway, quick word from you, Brenda, on this company that you can hire fake protesters.
It sounds to me a bit like the documentary that was on the other night about Facebook, where you could hire companies sitting in less well-developed parts of the world who actually spend all their time logging in and logging out of fake accounts to create likes for companies so that their profile gets raised. Seems very similar to this, but Martin's absolutely right. In the Labour Party, we do not go around paying people. We protest because we believe in it.
Okay, thanks, Brenda. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest you just heard, Bristol's Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Education, Labour Councillor for Southmead, Brenda Massey. After the news, American Frank Wisner in Egypt.
Is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.